kind of just a real housekeeping.
Our environment committee, welcome to. Good morning, everyone. Sunny day, dare we say it? Spring day?
I hope not yet.
Not quite yet. Our first item on the agenda is the informational meeting for Water for Life. So, Richard, are you ready to come forward on that? Welcome.
Good morning. Richard Kosasan with Water for Life. I'm basically pitch hitting this morning for Brad Harper, who's the executive director, and was unable to be here. Water for Life basically started as a result of legislation passed in 1987. That legislation required every individual in the state of Oregon who diverts water, and waters contained game fish of any type, to screen their water diversion. Historically, the screening requirements for diversions in the state of Oregon applied only to diversions that were 30 CFS cubic feet per second and over. This extended that requirement across the board to anyone diverting water. In 87, the Department of Fish and Wildlife suggested there were about 55,000 water diversions in the state requiring screening. About 3,240 of those were further identified by the Fish and Wildlife Department as priority diversions. The department at that time suggested a cost, I believe, of about $20 to $25 million to screen those 3,240 diversions. The legislation, I think, was rather quiet in nature. After the session closed, a lot of water users began to realize the significance of that legislation. In 1989, the Fort Klamath Water Users Group came back and said, in light of the significance of that legislation, they asked for a two-year moratorium on that screening requirement. If that legislation was indeed enacted in 89, and during the 89-91 interim period, Fort Klamath Water Users Association, along with some others, basically conceived Water for Life, which is a nonprofit organization within the state, primarily representing private irrigators throughout the state. In 1991, Water for Life came back and cooperatively worked within Representative Dave McTeague and his office staff, and developed a cooperative cost-sharing program for the screening of diversions. And in 91, it was conceived that screening should be installed in priority diversions throughout the state. And the cooperative cost-share program was developed basically suggesting that the diverter would be responsible for a third of the cost. Sportsmen, through license fees, would be responsible for a third of the cost. And the diverter was eligible for a tax credit of 50% of the installation costs. So the general fund picked up a portion. That was modified in 1995, but is still active. I think it's a very strong program, and I think it's a program that demonstrates that the cooperative nature can work.
Excuse me, Richard, would you repeat that one more time? The sportsman paid a third, the general fund picked up some. What was the first one?
Chairman Close, in 91 it was really started out, a cost share where a third and a third. The diverter was responsible for a third of the cost for the installation and maintenance of the screen. Sportsman, through a surcharge on license fees, picked up a third of the cost, and the general fund picked up a portion of the cost through the means of a tax credit. Water for Life has been active really for the last 10, 11, 12 years. They, in 1995, worked again cooperatively with the department on a measure to exempt small stock ponds. And in accordance with statutes, those are impoundments of less than 9.2 acre feet or with a structure of less than 10 feet in height. In 97, they worked on legislation dealing with livestock facilities to try to find a mechanism to get livestock outside and away from the immediate riparian areas. In terms of the current session, they have two proposals, well, basically three areas. Two bills, Senate Bill 17 and Senate Bill 18, deal with the adjudication process. I hope that you have the opportunity to review those pieces of legislation. And the third area, Water for Life, will be involved with, will be the debate and concerns raised with regard to the water quality management planning process.
Hey, could I ask you the size of Water for Life, how many members you have, and what size of budget, what the major source is?
Sure, close. Again, I wish Brad Harper, the executive director, was here. My understanding, there is approximately 700-plus members statewide.
Do you know the major source for your budget?
Private irrigators.
So dues? Mm-hmm. Is there dues that they pay?
Correct.
Are there questions for Water for Life?
You'd ask about the budget. I'd like to get that when it's once available. Well, you'll probably saw that. Are you $100,000 or $1 million, you know, somewhere in between, you know, range of organization?
Representative King, I will ask that question. I don't know off the top of my head.
One other question.
Go on.
I can see how they're involved in the process of, you know, working with legislation. Are there other things that they do, you know, that are, it's more at a local level as versus, you know, state?
Representative King, in the Klamath Basin, they have been active for the last 10, 12-year period, again, with some efforts to install screens, watershed management. So I think a portion of the association has always been involved with educational efforts.
So they would do work with watershed councils and soil districts on an ongoing basis as well, then probably at the local level.
Correct.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Richard, the membership, 700 members, and maybe you can't answer this, but is this principally in the Klamath Basin, or is it statewide? Is it, you know, what kind of distribution or distribution bias, if that's the right word, might there be?
Representative Jensen, I believe their focal point truly is, again, in the Klamath Basin. But subsequent to 89, 90, and 91, it has expanded out. It's fairly well distributed statewide.
Representative Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Besides the three areas you mentioned, do you, as an organization, have some concerns about the ongoing debate and something I think is going to be fairly well debated this time concerning groundwater?
Indeed, Representative Cruz. Is that sufficient for an answer this morning?
Probably not, Madam Chair, I just wanted to bring that up. I certainly the areas you talked about are important, but I also think groundwater is going to be a major water issue during this session. And I just wanted to get that on the record.
Bingley.
Richard, is your organization concerned about when the application of the Endangered Species Act occurs that water rights will not be served by priority?
I'm glad to see
what a handoff.
Sure, close, and Representative Lee, yes. A work group, as you are well aware, took a look at that during the interim period. I think that is a major issue for the state of Oregon. It is a very, very significant issue, short-term and long-term. It would be our hope that, irrespective of the outcome of those discussions, you maintain a priority basis. I don't see how you can get away from servicing the most senior user first. If that's changed, then I think we're in for some major problems.
Thank you. Representative Curtis?
Yeah, thank you. Are we any closer to seeing light at the end of the tunnel in the Klamath Basin? Well, I mean, you know,
I wonder what that light source is.
Well, I mean, it's so multi-jurisdictional and so convoluted.
The Klamath Basin, in terms of the current adjudication process, is rather different than anything in the past, in the sense that this is the first time you have a significant amount of water tied to federally reserved claims. In the Klamath adjudication process right now, you have approximately 700 claimants. About 400 of those come from Federal Reserve claims or government claims, as opposed to private irrigators. So in terms of the adjudication process across the state, this is a very unique experience and a very, very significant issue for the water users in the Klamath Basin.
A follow-up? More to point, when you were saying you were hoping we would see some Senate bills, do you think that shows us a way towards the light at the end of the tunnel? I mean, I guess my sense is that at some point we need to come to a resolution of this thing.
Representative Cruz, the two proposals, I believe, would clarify portions of the law. Currently, there are provisions in Chapter 539 that would provide someone during the adjudication process dissatisfied to post a bond to stay the order of determination issued by the department. The statute is silent in terms of the bond amount. If you are required in any other portion of statutes in the state of Oregon to require a person to obtain a bond or a letter of credit, there generally is an amount tied to that. The statute as constructed today is silent on that, so if someone went to obtain a bond, they could be asked to post a dollar bond or a $100 million bond. There's no logic, rhyme, or reason to it. So the first piece of legislation we have simply is to stipulate that a bond amount will be set at $25,000. The second issue, I think, is a little bit more difficult. There is a long-standing, I think, debate in terms of when the department has the authority to enforce during the adjudication process. Is that the department issues an administrative order, or and before the circuit court issues a decree, or after the circuit court issues the decree? It's our contention there clearly that you have to wait for the circuit court to issue that decree before enforcement can take effect. And that is basically what Senate Bill 18 is intended to accomplish.
Thank you.
And we will be looking forward to seeing that bill come our way and be able to debate it. Any other questions for Water for Life? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2108. And the committee might remember this bill dealt with the Pacific Ocean Resources Compact. We had testimony previously on this. We wanted to make some phone calls and find out some opinions with our federal representatives. And so we've done that, and Megan's going to give you a little bit of a report on that.
I spoke with Washington State, Alaska, Hawaii, and California, and all of them said there's no pending legislation, no talk of doing any sort of work along those lines with the compact. It was something that was definitely not on their radar screen. So at this point, none of the states are interested in it, in that form, in that work. And I also, another question issue that came up was the question of other organizations that were multi-state, and I put together in your packet, I found two that is very active. The States and British Columbia Oil Spill Task Force. They are an active group that deal with issues related to oil, which
the Compact did as well, and the Pacific Fisheries Legislative Task Force. They are also very active. I talked with Senator Dukes, who's on this task force, and they are very active. And I gave some supporting documents, if you were behind the first summary page on each of these organizations. The other two were the Pacific Fishery Management Council and Pacific States Marine Fisheries Commission. Also, obviously, did more along the lines of marine life versus oil issue. But those were the organizations that I found in my study that answered the question of who else is doing this sort of work that the Compact may do. I talked with Senator Gordon Smith's office. They did not see any need for this from a federal perspective, and I left some messages with some of the congressional delegations, and they never got back to me. So that's the perspective from the federal limited.
Yeah. Okay, Representative Cruz, since you're on this, I'd like to have Rupert.
Well, no, I got a question for Megan before we get into that. These two compacts that are active, what have they actually accomplished other than actively meeting? Or do they have a list of accomplishments?
They do have a list of accomplishments. They've both have good websites. But the Pacific Fisheries Legislation Task Force, when I was talking with Senator Duke, they lobby Congress on specific issues and went and talked to Congress on the groundfish issue recently. I felt like they played a key role in helping out sort of legislation. And I did not get through the coordinator for the state's British Columbia Oil Spill Task Force is actually a woman who works at our DEQ office in Portland, and was unable to get a hold of her and get specifics of what they're actively doing, what their current issues are.
Representative Lane.
Yes, I'd like to ask a question of Terry Thompson at some point. And that is, I don't know if what we're looking at is the proper forum, but perhaps one of those three entities needs to be dealing with our big invasive species problems that are coming up. I'd like to hear from Terry if he thinks any of the three of these work on that area.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Lee. Terry Thompson, former legislator. And to answer your question, because I was trying to answer his question first, and yours. To your question, if you don't mind, and then if you'll repeat your question, because to your question, what they've accomplished, Pacific Legislative Task Force has done exactly what Representative Lee is asking. They have accomplished in bringing all the states aware of the invasive species problem and to specific animals. It was through the Pacific Fisheries Legislative Task Force that created the invasive species forum and then later put actually people in charge of working with invasive species in the state. They also did similarly in other states. They've raised the priority of the zebra mussel and the mitten crab, which is one that has tremendous potential to move into the area and destroy a lot of the farm dikes and has done a lot of damage in the state of California, and they can live in this state. So to your question on invasive species, there are already doing a lot in that area and trying to raise the priorities. We work with a group of scientists. Now back to his question, which is what else have they accomplished? It was through the Pacific Fisheries Legislative Task Force that there was it originally came from this legislature, a memorial, which the high seas drift net fishery, which was wiping out albacore and salmon. It was 2,000 Japanese boats and several other countries that were involved in fishing offshore outside of the 200-mile limit. There was a memorial passed here and then picked up by the Pacific Fisheries Legislative Task Force and then went to Washington, D.C., that actually has removed that fleet from the North Pacific and is one of the reasons for the major increase in the albacore fishery on this state. They have been involved in education and working with Canada and the United States to remove part of the barriers and resolve part of the problems in the transboundary fisheries. Not every meeting, I can say, has been productive, but every meeting has been educational that I was involved in 6 years. And I hope that Representative Cruz gets a chance to sit on it before he leaves this body, because I think you'll find that it's a very effective group.
Madam Chair,
I
wasn't casting aspersions at any group. I'm just wanting to find out what actually is being done.
Yeah, I understand.
Representative Morgan.
The, Terry, there are other issues, and we grappled in the last session with issues relating to laying cables out on the ocean floor, and there are issues related to marine gravel mining. What would be the forum for those kinds of issues to be discussed amongst the states?
In this relationship, Madam Chair, Representative Morgan, in relationship to marine gravel mining, I'm not sure exactly what you're referring to. There is manganese nodules in deep water. Is that what you're referring to?
Mm-hmm.
There is no forum at this time, and that may be why this legislation came into existence. At this point, it isn't economically feasible to do that, to my knowledge. I don't know of any place in the world that is, but there is the value there. It's just a matter of developing the extraction methods which make it cost efficient.
So this could potentially be a forum where that issue could be and brought out for discussion.
It is potentially a place where that could be. I agree. And for marine cables, too, it's possible. I didn't try to remove this because of marine cables, because I do work with them. In fact, I hadn't even thought of the relationship with marine cables until you just brought it up.
Is there another forum where the fiber optic cable issue can be brought forward and discussed amongst the states?
To my knowledge, the fiber optic cable is brought out by an international agreement back when they first started, actually started between England and France when they first started laying cables, and that has been the law that they've maintained, which basically says they can go anywhere they want and do anything they want with these cables. It's because of the work here in this state that we've worked out agreements to improve the relationship between the fishing industry and cables. In fact, from what we've done here, now it's looking like the rest of the world starting to think that maybe what we're doing is the right way, and not do it through a confrontive mechanism where they just came in and said, hey, we're taking over, but now working through a compatible. Not every place in the world is going to be able to accomplish what we did, because we have a more educated fleet than a lot of the other places.
Madam Chair, if I may, I remember discussing this issue in the last session and having some difficulty in gathering information from Washington State and California about how they dealt with some of the fiber optic cable issues that we were having to face in Oregon. And I wonder if that may be one of the valuable pieces in keeping this on the books, in that we would have a forum in which to discuss those issues.
It may very realistically be. Apparently there's a letter from Department of State Lands,
right.
And one of the reasons that I brought this forward, believe me, is not to, I couldn't on the surface see any reason, but if there is a group that came forward, and that's what I think we need to do once in a while in our state laws, is go back and look and see if we have a purpose for it. And if they've said there is a purpose for it, I'm more than happy to let this bill die. But from the surface, looking at it in my experience, I didn't see a reason for it. If it looks like there is a purpose, I'm more than happy to see the bill die.
Thank you. I'd like to call, since we have this letter that has just been delivered to your committee, I could call up Bob Randy of LSD, Land Conservation and Development. They can speak to their concerns. And also to tell the committee, you know, you do have the statute in your packet. You might want to look at it pretty well. It spells out what the purpose of this commission is. I was looking for the gravel issues. I couldn't find them in statute. Or the cable issues, but stuff you might want to look at. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bob Rindy with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. And with me today is Don Oswald, our coastal coordinator. First of all, we apologize that we weren't prepared last Monday and hadn't finished our analysis on this bill. We felt at this point that our primary role might be to be able to give you some more background on the potential of this statute. It's not something that we're here to, you know, advocate strongly for or against, but the potential seemed to us to be something that you should consider, and for that reason I apologize, Mr. Bailey could not Bailey, our ocean coordinator who wrote this testimony, could not be here this morning, but Don will try to fill in and give you some more background.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, As Bob just said, I'll do my best to give you some perspective from the department, even though our principal ocean specialist couldn't be here. You've heard a lot about forums discussions just a little while ago, and while it's true there are various other federal and state forums operating that address various issues on the ocean resources, I think the compact that's embodied in the current statute actually creates some regulatory authority that these other forums do not possess. I think this current compact, if it was ever enacted, would give Oregon and other Western states a certain management and regulatory clout with the federal government that they do not now enjoy. Particularly outside the territorial sea in the remainder of the 200-mile exclusive economic zone. And to our way of thinking, it seems wise to have on the books a potential tool for dealing with the federal government rather than not having it and having to scramble to create authorities politically with working with Congress and whatnot when something, you know, crisis arises. We think it wiser to have something in place. We're not aware of any problem with the statute being in place, so we're just kind of would caution the committee that before you decide to delete these authorities, you make a pretty thorough examination of the actual authorities embodied in the compact versus what authorities these other forums might have. That's all I have. Any questions?
I have a question. Can you tell me in statute, I'm looking at Article 5 specifically, it seems like most of the authority for this group has to do with oil spills. And in your letter, you've mentioned the gravel mining and the fiber optic cable. Can you just tell me, you know, where their authority would extend to those? Is there a section that would...
Unfortunately, Madam Chair, I'm not enough of an expert on the statute to answer your question specifically. We would be more than willing to provide an analysis, more detailed analysis of this compact, and provide it to the committee that could answer that question and many others about specific issues that where they're addressed, because I think that's an important question.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I understand, the statute requires that before we have a Pacific Ocean Resources Compact to be Oregon and two other states need to ratify or need to become parties to that. At the present time, it's also my understanding that since its inception, no other states have come forward.
Correct.
On that. It's also my understanding that would need an act of Congress to ratify.
That's correct.
As a consequence, and respectfully, I'm hard-pressed to understand the merit of your argument. If an issue were to come forward, it's going to require two other states to, in a legislative session, to enact, you know, this. It's going to require Congress to pass or ratify it. And if such an issue then were ever present, it would be relatively simple for this legislative body to proceed and reenact or do whatever else was necessary to become a party to that pact. It looks to me like it's, you know, in fact, a dead horse. And, you know, in my country, you try not to get stuck riding a dead horse any further than you need to.
Representative Jensen, yeah, I would not characterize it as a dead horse. It's just a horse standing around ready to run a race, actually. And yes, it would take two legislative acts by other states and Congress, but if you remove this legislation, these statutes, it would take three legislative acts. And I know you know that legislation is not always a foregone conclusion, no matter what the issue.
Just a quick response on the horse issue. It's also my experience that if you have a horse standing around, that's not a horse you want to rely on when you get into a race.
My taken.
Following up a little bit, even if all those other pieces of legislation happen, they're not going to happen exactly as our, you know, as our statute is, and we'd have to repass concurrences and revisit it anyway. So we don't really have anything that's, you know, realistically likely to function, even in the event that you know, the other states or the feds were to enact, you know, a comparable compact.
It's likely that the Oregon statute would serve as a model for other states, but it's, of course, not guaranteed that they would adopt it in exactly the same form.
Madam Chair, Representative King, it's one of the things Mr. Bailey informed me is that there is a great deal of work that went into passing this statute, and we would try to give you some more information on that. But it is not inconceivable to me that the amount of effort getting Oregon at least this far was considerable. And again, I think the point that we were trying to make here is there doesn't seem to be a downside. There are hundreds and hundreds of statutes on the books that, and arguably, I'm not trying to say you should keep all of those, but they're there. And here's one, unlike a lot of them, that at least gets us this far on a very long course that we may have to get into if down the road there's some sort of crisis where this authority would be beneficial to. And we're simply asking the question is, what is lost, really, what is lost if this is left in place and the work we have gone into so far, or that you and your participants went into, is simply left in place? It is, in fact, a head start should something happen, something arise down the road where other states would be interested in this. We don't have to reinvent all of that work. That's simply all we're arguing here.
Madam Chair, I was looking in Article 5, 1A, Big B, and it talks about how the United States Coast Guard shall adopt the recommendations of the compact. I realize the compact hasn't formed with the other states, but I take a look at what happened with New Carissa and how now the owners of the New Carissa are suing the Coast Guard. And if I'm just trying to be visionary here, if the United States Coast Guard had, if the compact had existed and had was a part of the rulemaking process, that maybe the Coast Guard, which they are alleged to have had inaccurate maps, they hadn't updated what I don't, Terry can answer those questions better than I can regarding why the Carissa did actually get beached. And so again, it is a mechanism, whether it would ever be used or not, I don't know, but at least there is a mechanism here, and especially since we had the New Carissa as well as now this lawsuit against the United States Coast Guard, this does provide the statute for that.
Representative Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If indeed we have a motion to move this bill, I will vote against it, and the reasons are this. Number one, this is on the books. It's already been through that process. Number two, it is costing us absolutely nothing at this point in time. I mean, absolutely nothing. One small percent of 1 cent as far as the cost of printing, but removing a couple pages from the ORS really doesn't reduce that cost, I don't think. But I think more importantly, For some of the reasons that Representative Morgan brought up and maybe some others, this does give us a forum and an advocacy position in trying to get other states on board with a process, because we would have a stronger advocacy if we're saying we've already got this, we need you guys to do it so we can move ahead, rather than saying we all ought to do something when we don't, when we haven't taken the first step. So the first step has already been taken. We may never need it, but we've got it there, and since how it costs us nothing to have it there, I think we ought to leave the tool in the toolbox.
Representative Haas.
I frankly see no harm in letting this stay on the books, and I was just, to be honest with you, waiting to see where Representative Cruz was and deferring to him since he's our designee on this.
Maybe I'm making, what he's talking about.
Point of clarification. Madam Chair, the fact that I am the designee does not make me an expert on anything, because we've never met. So you know, in fact, I haven't even printed that on my letterhead, to be quite honest with you. So it, you know, if it disappeared, I wouldn't have to change letterhead or anything. But the fact is that I do think it's a tool that doesn't cost us anything to leave in the box. So that's kind of it.
Representative King.
And Representative Cruz hasn't yet, during this work session, declared his potential conflict of interest. Duncan, you might have to go on.
There's no motion, so I haven't got there yet.
I'm wondering if this involves Hawaii. Representative Morgan.
First meeting. Madam Chair, I'd just like to go on record also as concurring with Representative Cruz's comments. I think that this is by no means an ideal vehicle to discuss these issues and create a forum, but I think that it does signal our willingness to, if the situation arises, kind of get this thing, get some legs under this and get it rolling. And I don't see the harm of leaving it on the books.
Thank you. One more comment, Representative Jefferson.
Madam Chair, while I favor taking the motion or taking the bill off of the books, the law off the books, I see no reason to have our statutes cluttered with things that are unused. If I can stay with the horse analogy, a line out of the Henry VIII, when he sentenced one of his constituents, I guess, to public execution, the man came forward and said, "Your Majesty, give me a year, and I'll teach you. I will teach your horse to talk." Henry VIII is reported to have said, "You know, but this is ridiculous. Horses can't talk. Why do you make such a ridiculous request?" Said, "Well, in a year, you may die. In a year, I may die. And in a year, maybe we'll have a need for it, or maybe the horse will talk."
Okay. Madam Chair, and the purpose in bringing this bill was basically to review and see if we needed it, and it appears to have a purpose. I'm wondering, though, that if through research we might find that by a change, since we have the bill in front of us, that it may be able to improve it some in the area of fiber optic cables and mineral mining, and turn it into a positive thing that may attract other states to move forward. We do have Pacific Fisheries Legislative Task Force, which could talk to other states about the value of this. If afterwards we could get together and talk, we may find that there's an advantage to this bill. And I appreciate the fact that we brought it forward before the committee, because so many of our bills do need to be reviewed every once in a while to see there is a purpose.
Well, I congratulate you for doing that, and we should keep looking at statutes carefully to see if we need to
discard them. Well, at the risk of beating a dead horse, I'm going to close the work session on this bill. And thank you very much for coming.
It shows the need for a sunset clause.
Committee, that's the last thing we have on our work for today. I just want to call your attention to Wendy's Wednesday agenda. We'll have two bills that will be up for public hearing. And I don't think that, Megan, you don't generally bring the bills, do you? You might want to bring your bills, have your staff pull them so that you can have them with you on Wednesday. Is there anything else for the good of the committee? Okay, we are adjourned. Ooh.